This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, June 7th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. In the U.S. judicial system, community standards, victims' rights, and judges' discretion are all important principles. But they all collided in a spectacular way in a California case this year. College swimmer Brock Turner was found guilty on 3 felony counts of sexual assault for raping an unconscious woman at Stanford University, where he was a student at the time. The counts carried a maximum sentence of 14 years in prison, and the prosecution was asking for 6 years. The judge in the case said 6 months in jail, not prison, was fine, and further said a longer sentence would have a severe impact on the 20-year-old. The defendant's father wrote a letter seeking sympathy from the community in which he said, these are his words, that 20 minutes of action should not wipe out his son's otherwise good conduct. The community he sought to reach has been overwhelmed by outrage and condemnation from quite another community focusing on the victim. The victim wrote a letter detailing her ordeal from the rape, and that story has attracted an even larger community of sympathizers online. Sophie Karasek is the director of education for End Rape on Campus, an advocacy group she helped found in 2013. She's a survivor of sexual assault herself. Sophie says supposedly comfortable ideas about community standards from a judge are a rocky cliff when society does not have consensus, in her view, on even the definition of sexual assault, and archaic norms of sexuality, she says, persist.
What he lost was concrete, you know, titles, degrees, the ability to be on this team. But what she lost was internal, the privacy and trust and confidence and her voice and sense of self.
What do you make of the father's letter, who claims that 20 minutes of action should not wipe out an entire life? And where's he coming from on that?
Yeah, it's completely ridiculous to make that kind of – to have that kind of reasoning for the severity of a crime. I mean, if somebody were to shoot me in the head and kill me, would you say that they should not be held accountable for that because it only took a second to pull the trigger? You know, we should not be judging the severity – of crimes based on the time that it took to commit them. Clearly, this person, this survivor, was incredibly impacted by what happened to them. And so the perpetrator of that crime needs to be held accountable for it. Again, as she so eloquently stated in her letter, we should not be learning that rape is wrong through trial and error. You need to be held accountable for it when you commit it.
Where does this father come from? I mean, what is this prevailing notion here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to the broader cultural sense that values the lives of men over the lives of women.
I mean, he's suggesting that there is a period in time when you're growing up when you rape and gosh, you really need to go on with your life. And boy, you learn from those mistakes, don't you? I mean, that's kind of where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And you're laughing out of a kind of a outrage and disgust.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I watched this clip on The Onion earlier basically saying having a similar reasoning of, you know, this poor college athlete is trying to get on with his life after he rapes somebody, you know. Isn't that admirable that he's trying to move on after the rape?
Do you think that there is a responsibility here on the part of the college?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a civil rights issue to have the right to be safe on your campus and to be free from a hostile environment. That's something that you're supposed to have under Title IX, the federal gender equity law. And that's what student activists have been really trying to draw attention to over the last couple of years, is that schools need to ensure that students aren't going through these experiences of sexual assault and sexual harassment and not having the effects of that addressed and the perpetrators held accountable if they report.
What is the judge's mission here, do you think, when you look at the verdict, look at the trial, and look at the fact that the letter from the victim was entered into the court record?
Yeah, so I think that it's worth pointing out that the judge in this case actually is a former captain of the Stanford lacrosse team. And I think it would be silly to think that that didn't have some sort of impact on how he saw the perpetrator and whether he thought that he would be a threat to society. So, you know, one of the things that he said was that he thought that, you know, it would have a severe impact on him and that we should basically not be afraid that he's going to do this again. And that was something that actually really angered me, both because, you know, it's completely crazy to have that type of mentality when we're resolving and trying to get justice for people, but also because I had a similar experience where my perpetrator was basically told, you know, just don't do it again. And that really is invalidating to the experience that I had.
There's also a question of if this had been a young black man, the idea that he could learn from just a short sentence is probably not going to be one that the judge would assume.
Yeah. And also the demonization of black men in our criminal justice system is very widespread. You know, there's lots of research that shows that people who are black get longer sentences. What the undercurrent of this is, well, now he doesn't get to go to the Olympics. You know, we don't get to have a rapist representing the United States at the Olympics.
Sophie Karasek is a sexual assault survivor from UC Berkeley. She's also director of education and co-founder for End Rape on Campus. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Judge Aaron Persky of the Santa Clara County Superior Court is the judge in this case, a name no one would know but for this case, which has now attracted 200,000 signatures, calling for the judge's removal and a hurried campaign to get someone to challenge him in his upcoming election, in which he's currently running unopposed. Lynn Hecht Schaffrin has been studying and educating judges on how to approach sexual assault cases for decades. She's the vice president at Legal Momentum and director for the National Judicial Education Program. She says there's a tension between judges' discretion and the temptation to install mandatory minimum sentences in cases like this, taking away all discretion from judges.
Sentences are pretty much, I don't want to say fixed. There is a lot of discretion, but the notion is that more and more we have moved to sentencing guidelines across the country because there has been so much difference between what one judge and another gives for the same offense. And so usually the statutes will say this crime deserves this level of punishment, let's say between 2 and 6 years, and there's discretion within that framework for the judge to decide what to impose.
Is there an orderly procedure for revisiting this particular case?
I don't know. I actually wrote to a colleague of mine who's a prosecutor in San Diego to ask whether what I had read about California law was accurate and whether this could be taken up as an illegal sentence. What could definitely happen here is, number one, there is a move now, a formal move, to have this judge recalled. But in addition to that, this judge could be formally censured. A few years ago, a judge in California made horrendous remarks in a rape case, condemning basically the victim for failing to resist in a case where her life was at risk. And the California Commission on Judicial Discipline publicly admonished him. I have a 2-day course for judges called Understanding Sexual Violence that I have given in more than 25 states over many years. And it just happened that I was sitting behind two judges as they listened to the section on offenders. And this was a particular description of a situation in a fraternity. And I could tell from the body language of these two men that they were made very, very uncomfortable by this. And when the presenter finished, one of these two men said to the room, "Well, I don't see that there was any rape there." That's what everybody does on a Saturday night when you're in college. You go out, you get drunk, you hope you get lucky. And the judge, who was the head of judicial education in that state, looked across the room at these two men and he said, "You know, there's a difference between hope and coercion."
Why would anyone come forth if they were the victim of a sexual assault in a situation where the presumption of innocence assumes that the perpetrator is innocent or has a whole life ahead of them?
Right.
Their value is already upgraded just by the presumption of innocence. And the presumption of innocence then implies a presumed skepticism on the part of the court of the woman who is presumed to be some kind of promiscuous
right.
Person. And that, of course, is always the defense. And why would you come forth in a situation like that? It is rigged against anyone accusing someone of a sexual right. crime.
Well, John, you have just enunciated, articulated something that I don't think many people understand about the fact that in U.S. law, there is this assumption that one is innocent until proven guilty. And that works fine in most cases. But in a situation of a sexual assault where the defense is consent, and when the parties come in and they're not in equipoise, it's not as if one side has to prove its view and the other side has to prove its view. It's exactly what you said. At the beginning of the case, the assumption is that the alleged victim consented. And although allegedly, let's say, the fiction is that the defendant is on trial, in point of fact, it's the victim who's on trial. And she or he has got to, quote unquote, prove in some way, demonstrate to the satisfaction of the jury, or if it's a bench trial, to the judge, that he or she did not consent, that this person did not agree to the sexual act that was perpetrated against them. But this is a very difficult situation in the law. And we have, over the years, looked for various ways to make these cases fairer, not in the sense of undermining defendants' rights, but in the sense of having the law and the process actually reflect what happens to victims in these traumatic situations. People really need to think very carefully about our attitudes toward it, our attitudes toward victims, whether they are men or women. I mean, we forget that a lot of men are victims as well, and they are even more reluctant to come forward because they are even more likely to be disbelieved.
Lynn Hecht Schaffran has been studying and educating judges on how to approach sexual assault cases for decades. She's the vice president at Legal Momentum and director for the National Judicial Education Program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, with packing, shipping, and moving supplies for both business and personal needs 7 days a week. Learn more at staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Governor John Hickenlooper is an unlikely politician, but a natural entrepreneur and a salesman. It made him a millionaire in the beer business, which made him a familiar enough face in Denver to be elected mayor. And that led to 2 terms as governor of the state of Colorado and being consistently shortlisted as a possible cabinet secretary or even becoming Hillary Clinton's running mate on the Democratic ticket. Hickenlooper's newly published memoir is not a job application, though. The opposite of woe, my life in beer and politics, is the governor's argument that authenticity, honesty, and building consensus and problem solving is the innovative mode in 21st century politics. It's worked for him, he says, and he believes people are hungry for it at the national level.
You know, my life could not get any better. I got married in January. The Broncos won the Super Bowl on my birthday in February. I'm looking over my shoulder because usually when things are going this well, there's some storm cloud over your shoulder that you can't quite see.
So would being named vice president be an extension of that streak, or would it be an interruption of that streak?
It might be the storm cloud. Who knows?
Yeah. You talk a lot about your record in Colorado, and I want to get to that. But what opportunities do you think you might have at the federal level, depending on how things go in this crazy election?
Oh, I don't know. I was owned the largest brew pub in the country and then somehow ended up becoming mayor and governor. I'm not sure my political prognostications are of great value. I do think that this is one of the craziest election seasons that in my entire life I've never seen such wild turbulence of what people think and what people say and anger and joy. It's amazing.
But you're not out on a limb there saying it's a kind of a crazy election season. What do you think the opportunities are, though, for leadership? Forget about, what's going to happen to you specifically. But, I mean, you are someone who's gotten into a situation, changed things, seen the opportunities where maybe others haven't. What do you think this kind of a turning point possibly means for change in America?
Well, I think one thing, obviously, we've talked about this before, that I think we should get more people from everyday life, more small business people. I was in the restaurant business, but more people into elected office that bring some of those lessons, the common sense that, that one needs to succeed in small business. I think that's sort of what the founding fathers intended. People go out into the world, they, you know, engage, they win, they fail, they struggle, they learn, they lose. You know, they go through all those life adventures, and then they come back and take the hopefully the wisdom that they accumulate and put that to good use in terms of as a public servant.
Your book, which you're obviously very proud of, you know, it's a political memoir, but it's more than that. How would you describe it?
Well, I tried to write, you know, my whole life. The majority of the book is after I got elected to be mayor, you know, did 8 years as mayor and then 5.5 years as governor. But I also went back to my childhood and my, you know, my dad dying when I was eight and my mom raising four kids by herself. And I also tried to describe what a jerk I was, you know, warts and all. Show them who you are, who you were. Hopefully I've grown past a lot of the dumb things I did when I was younger.
Your dad died when you were eight?
Yeah, he died 2 weeks after my eighth birthday.
You describe the decision you made to go to a party on the day, I believe, of your dad's funeral, right?
Yeah. Well, no, it was the day my mother told me that he had died. Mm-hmm. She came home and I was coming down the stairs and we sat on the landing between the first and the second floor and she was very upset. My mother was tough, a very tough woman, grew up in the Depression, sewed all her own clothes, washed tinfoil and saran wrap to reuse it. She was very flinty, but she had tears in her eyes and she just said, I wanted you to know that your father died this morning. And I can remember thinking, because he, you know, I had hardly seen him. We'd gone to visit him in the hospital 2 weeks before. And he really couldn't speak. And I remember thinking, and it's, again, you go back and try to be as honest as you can, but I was going to my neighbor, Stuart Searing's, birthday party, and it was starting in 15 minutes, and I was thinking to myself, well, he's died. I guess I knew he was going to die. Is this going to take a long time? Am I going to be late for the birthday party? I mean, just so selfish and so narcissistic, you know, as only an 8-year-old can be. And go back and think about that and realize how hard that must have been on my mother, because I'm sure she could see that in me.
All right. Well, I guess, you know, one of the great advantages of being so candid and of having this experience and of having the success that you've had is that you can go into national politics if the opportunity is offered to you as someone who's, you know, dealt with your issues.
Well, somebody told me last week that if I intended the book as an audition for a higher office, they had a number of parts of the book that they would suggest that I should have left out. Because in a funny way, it's almost a call to arms of, you know, nerds everywhere. Because I was that kid. I was a skinny kid with acne and thick glasses. And, you know, I kind of outgrew that and was able – I have been able to play a significant role, at least in Colorado – and trying to make things better and create collaborative environments where, you know, the legislature comes together and we address some of these issues. I think nerds everywhere need to hear that they can, you know, if they're thinking about running for city council or mayor, they should do it.
Governor John Hickenlooper, Democratic Governor of Colorado, thanks so much.
It's a real pleasure. Always nice talking to you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. There just might be a newfound energy in the U.S. Congress among some lawmakers who've been stymied for years, with the din of the presidential race causing all kinds of headaches for Republicans and Democrats suddenly seeing light at the end of the tunnel, with Hillary Clinton now gaining the number of committed delegates to clinch the nomination for president. It's a historic milestone. A woman has never done that before in a major party. Suddenly, lawmakers, though, are seeing that getting things done on Capitol Hill might be a way of talking about something else besides the latest outburst from Donald Trump. There's a stack of issues that's piled up in Congress. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Welcome, Todd.
Hey, John.
So I talked to a congresswoman yesterday. I won't tell you her name, but she was saying, now we're going to get something done. It's great down there, referring to Capitol Hill. And she hasn't had a nice thing to say about her job in at least 3 years.
Well, nobody's described Capitol Hill as great in way more than 3 years, so I'm glad that member of Congress is so enthusiastic. Hey, John, I'll get the name of that congresswoman off the air. I got to go talk to her because I need some enthusiasm, too. It's been in short supply these days. However, Congresswoman is correct that there is a great deal of substance that can happen over the next kind of 6 weeks. Why? Because nothing works like a deadline on Capitol Hill. The election is coming, and this is the last gasp of the 114th Congress if they're going to get some money must pass stuff done. That's why things might be great. They got to get it done. But there is a cloud over all of this, John, and it is for Republicans. We'll get to the substance in 1/2 second. But Donald Trump's comments on Judge Gonzalo Curiel, everybody's familiar with them, that he can't be impartial because he's Mexican. It's tying Republicans in knots. Comments coming from all over the Republican kingdom now, trying to distance themselves from Donald Trump. This morning, Paul Ryan himself called those comments the textbook definition of a racist comment. At the same time, he said that Donald Trump and Republicans have more similarities than differences. And our pal Lindsey Graham said it's the most un-American thing from a politician since Joe McCarthy. And if Republicans are looking for an off-ramp from Donald Trump, that this is it. That's what Lindsey Graham said. So it is a problem. And I bring it up because at the same time, Paul Ryan, the leader of the Republicans, the Speaker of the House, is trying very hard to roll out a positive agenda for Republicans in 2017 for what Republicans want to do. He started to roll out an anti-poverty agenda today. Listen to Paul Ryan.
Let's face it. People know what Republicans are against. Now, we're going to give you a plan that shows you what we are for.
John, Republicans are going to be talking about national security. You'll be interested to know they'll be talking about Medicare, too. That might interest you since that's creeping up. But they're also talking about...
Oh, get out!
They're also talking about poverty today. They're also talking about poverty today. Republicans want to consolidate poverty programs and give voters a reason to vote for them in a positive way in 2017. And here's part of also the strategy is the substance that I just promised you that's going to happen over the next couple of weeks. Zika funding is on tap. There's a major disagreement between the House and the Senate now over how to fund Zika, but they both have bills passed. The Senate wants $1.1 billion. The House wants $622 million with no new money. The public health experts want $1.9 billion, and that's what the White House wants. So there's going to be a big debate. They're also going to do some substance on how to help Puerto Rico restructure $73 billion in debt. Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi have an agreement. A lot of conservatives don't like it. A lot of liberals don't like it. But Pelosi and Ryan, John, think that they have enough people in the middle in the House to institute a control board in Puerto Rico, restructure some of the pensions and social services, not spend any new bailout money on Puerto Rico, and try to get a plan in place for that faltering Commonwealth.
So, and that would be huge, dealing with Puerto Rico. Before we go, the judge that Trump is talking about isn't even Mexican. He's from Indiana. Is the Republican Party that we're talking about not even Trump at this point?
You know, this is part of the problem that's twisting them into knots, John, is how far they can go to be the party of Trump and not turn on him when he's saying things like that. It's getting harder.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Yesterday, Vice President Biden spoke to the largest annual meeting of cancer researchers in the world in Chicago.
Imagine if you all worked together. I've had a chance to speak with the head of each one of these organizations. You're spending hundreds of millions of dollars. Imagine if it was coordinated.
We choose to go to the moon, he might as well have been saying. Vice President Biden was in Chicago promoting a new database of genomic and clinical patient data meant to scale up both the amount of raw data and the number of researchers with access to it. The hope is to identify patterns in how patients with different cancers respond to treatments to tailor future interventions more precisely. The White House moonshot approach to cancer possibly misses a broader point, though, in medical research. And researchers are debating this right now. Cancer doesn't have one cause any more than there is one kind of corrosion for objects exposed to the elements. Whether it's cancer or heart disease or stroke or diabetes, the greatest risk factor is aging. Matt Kaeberlein is co-director of the University of Washington Nathan Schock Center of Excellence in the Basic Biology of Aging.
Over the last couple of decades, we've learned a lot about the molecular processes that drive aging and why those processes lead to increased risk for all of these diseases of aging.
Do you believe our popular notions of disease have kept up with this phenomenon of life expectancy and the ways in which cancer and dementia present themselves, in that we're still thinking about infectious disease and looking for cures and vaccinations, when in fact cancer and other diseases associated with longer lifespans present themselves in fundamentally different ways?
It's definitely true that historically, infectious disease and non-age-related diseases have been the major killers in most parts of the world. And certainly in some parts of the world, that's still true. But as sanitation has improved and antibiotics have become widely available, these people are living longer and these diseases of aging are becoming much more important. And I think that those of us who study the biology of aging really view the path forward more as one of trying to understand what's this relationship between the biology of aging and age-related diseases. Because if we can understand that, we have the potential to actually target those processes and delay the onset and progression of age-related diseases to keep people healthier longer.
Do you think that when you hear a moonshot coming from the White House on the issue of curing cancer, that people are necessarily going to think of another bug hunt where we're looking for a specific virus and therefore then a specific vaccine, et cetera?
Maybe. I think that people who don't understand the biology of cancer often want to link all cancers together as sort of one disease. And the reality is that different forms of cancer in many ways are very different diseases. And so it's certainly not trivial to develop a quote-unquote cure for cancer, right? Because these are many, many different diseases. And even at an individual level, every cancer can be somewhat different.
Is it the case that with cancer, you're talking about the story of cells that grow up and wear out and begin to malfunction? And with dementia, its brains grow up and through age begin to malfunction? And that's really what's going on here, rather than people getting sick per se from some external factor?
In a general sense, there is some truth to that. So what we know is that there are molecular changes that occur as we get older. This is part of the normal aging process that everybody goes through. And it's those molecular changes that lead to your increased risk for developing dementia or cancer or diabetes or kidney disease. And in fact, if you actually look at the risk associated with these diseases, we know about a lot of risk factors. So aging is really the primary driver of all of these diseases. And it's the molecular processes that we're starting to understand.
Matt Kaeberlein is co-director of the University of Washington Nathan Schock Center of Excellence in the Basic Biology of Aging. Dr. Kaeberlein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We began this hour considering how a verdict in California in a sexual assault case may have become a reason to reconsider social norms in the case of sexual assault. Well, in 1981, the perception of leniency turned deadly when a largely black jury in Alabama failed to reach a verdict in the trial of a black man accused of murdering a white Birmingham police sergeant. Well, the Alabama chapter of the United Klans of America, the KKK, sought revenge by abducting and hanging Michael Donald, a 19-year-old black teenager, from a tree. The Klan members were later convicted, but some activists felt as though the trial confined itself to the issue of a few bad apples without taking on the Klan itself and its impact on society. Morris Dees, a prominent civil rights lawyer and founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, decided to file a civil lawsuit against the United Klans of America. It was a brand new, ultimately historic approach to civil rights. And that trial is the subject of a new book, The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. Author Lawrence Lamer says Morris Dees went through a radical rethinking personally, which has transformed civil rights law in America.
You know, Morris Dees is this segregationist. He's a kid. He grows up. He's got black friends, but he totally believes in segregation. He goes to the University of Alabama. In 1958, he takes a semester off to be George Wallace's campaign manager in his first run for governor. Wallace was a way-out segregationist, and Morris Dees believed in everything that Wallace was saying. 3 years later, in 1961, at the time of the Freedom Rides, when Freedom Riders were beaten up and half killed in Montgomery, Alabama, Morris Dees defended the leader of the Klan in Montgomery. So then he slowly began to realize what was wrong, what an evil system this was, and he turned around.
And what did he imagine that he could do to change things? I mean, there were all sorts of federal initiatives afoot, but here his change of heart wasn't going to be seen as credible by Alabamans.
No, I mean, he was totally outcast, but he thought the law could be used. He thought there was a place for a civil rights law firm that would use the law as a positive force. And that's one of the often untold stories of the civil rights movement, is the way it wasn't just protest, it was a matter of law, of these people pushing the law and finding the kind of judges that would take the actions that had to be taken.
Why is it that Morris Dees has the insight, do you think, before almost anyone else, to use the civil courts as an economic weapon against the Klan when the Klan had been so successful in covering up their own crimes or, you know, destroying enough evidence so that it was really impossible to pin it on them, even though maybe in certain cases everyone in town knew who had done it?
He's very iconoclastic. He always walks his own walk. And that he went after the Klan, he brought together a group of very brilliant young lawyers from the North, a half a dozen lawyers, to work with him. They didn't like what he was doing. They thought that the Southern Poverty Law Center that he founded was firebombed. They were afraid for their lives. They didn't want to do this. And they ended up quitting and leaving rather than going ahead with this.
Describe the incident that becomes the lawsuit that really is the frame of this entire story.
Well, in 1981, Michael Donald, a 19-year-old black teenager, was walking on a Friday evening. He was picked up by two Klansmen and brutally murdered and lynched and hung in a tree in a street in Mobile. They didn't want this to be called a lynching. So the establishment and the police arrested three young men who basically were drug dealers and accused them of this crime. And they could have gone to prison. They could have been executed for a crime they didn't commit so that Mobile's reputation would be unsullied. But the Justice Department came down and got involved. And a black attorney, Thomas Figures, and Barry Kowalski, an attorney from Washington, came down. And they began to investigate this. And with the help of James Bodman, an FBI agent, they found the true killers, who were members of the Klan, James Tiger Knowles and Henry Hayes.
Dees sort of understood that he could take the Klan and make them liable in this case. But did he believe that he could take them down economically?
Well, nobody had ever done this before. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing about Morris Dees. He invented a new kind of theory of law, that he would take the organization and make the organization responsible for what a couple of its members had done. And certainly he hoped if he won this, he would get a big judgment and would break them economically.
And what was the Klan's response?
The Klan and the Klan lawyers thought it was a joke. They thought this was just some more harassment and it would go nowhere.
Was it a jury or a judge that decided?
It was a jury, and it was a white jury.
And how did the case proceed? What was it like in the courtroom, do you think?
The mother of Michael Donald, Mrs. Donald, she was sitting there. She had not gone to the murder trial because she was afraid bad things would be said about her son. And they were totally untrue things, as if this were his fault. Two of the killers, one of them, Henry Hayes, was executed. Tiger Knowles pled and was in a federal prison for what was life imprisonment. He was so emotionally disengaged. When he talked about the murder, it was as if someone else had done it. It had nothing to do with him. It was a total voice without any emotion at all. And on the final day of the trial, when the final statements were being made, Tiger asked, "Can I speak one more time?" And now a lot of lawyers, it was up to Morris Dees, and a lot of lawyers would say, "Let's not do this. Our case is going just fine. I don't know what he's going to say. I don't know how he's going to say it. And if he's going to say it, I'm going to tell him what to say." But Morris Dees didn't do that. He just let Tiger get up there and say what he did. And Tiger just was in tears saying, "I'm so sorry I did this. This was a horrible thing. We deserve to be punished for this. I deserve to be punished. I'm so sorry, Mrs. Donald. I'm so sorry I've done this." And Mrs. Donald looked out at him and said, "I forgive you, Tiger. I forgive you." And even the judge was in tears.
So how did that moment become an understanding that an organization like the Klan could have created a killing machine in the minds of so many people like Tiger, that they would be liable and would have to pay the price, really, of their existence?
That's what they had to do in the courtroom. They had to show that Robert Shelton, the Klan leader, had spoken this violent rhetoric, and he had motivated these people to do these evil things. But, it's like a drug dealer who once out of jail never gets caught holding. Robert Shelton never got caught holding either. He always managed to keep his distance from him. Other people did the killings. Other people did the terrible acts. But Morris Dees was able to link him to it.
And when the final verdict came down, what was the way in which this was covered?
Well, it was a big story throughout America. The $7 million judgment basically destroyed the United Clans of America. I mean, they didn't have much money. They had a facility, a building that was worth only about $60,000. They took that. But psychologically, it was devastating. And equally important, they had this new way of going after these groups. In the next decades, every group that got big and got its head up too high, they went after them with the same legal theory and broke them down. That's why now, yes, you have these racist groups out there, but they're small groups and nothing like what we've known historically.
And the Southern Poverty Law Center got its start with that lawsuit, and it's just as powerful today. But what do you think the legacy is for the law in the sense that you can be liable for a doctrine that has consequences that, in the case of the Klan, are fatal?
Well, it's a very subtle thing. As the defense attorneys talked about in the 1987 trial, I mean, people have a right to free speech, and you can say what you want, but you can't promote somebody to commit an act of violence. That's the difference. That's the distinction.
Lawrence Lamer is the award-winning author and journalist of the latest book, The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. Thanks so much, Lawrence.
Thanks, Jeff.
Here's a quick takeaway. On this day in 1892, Homer Plessy was arrested for his refusal to move from a whites-only seat on a train, leading to Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court decision, which claimed the doctrine of separate but equal and appropriate principle of American life, a principle overturned in 1954, which we consider an outrage today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.